Chapter 18. Government Functions. The study of human institutions is always a search for the most tolerable imperfections. Richard A. Epstein. A modern market economy cannot exist in a vacuum. Market transactions take place within a framework of rules and require someone with the authority to enforce those rules. Government not only enforces its own rules, but also enforces contracts and other agreements and understandings among the numerous parties transacting with one another in the economy. Sometimes government also sets standards, defining what is a pound, a mile, or a bushel. In order to support itself, a government must also collect taxes, which in turn influence economic decision-making by those affected by those taxes. Beyond these basic functions, which virtually everyone can agree on, governments can play more expansive roles, all the way up to directly owning and operating all the farms and industries in a nation. Controversies have raged around the world, for more than a century, on the role that government should play in the economy. For much of the 20th century, those who favored a larger role for government were clearly in the ascendancy, whether in democratic or undemocratic countries. The Soviet Union, China, and others in the communist bloc of nations were at one extreme, but democratic countries like Britain, India, and France also had their governments take over ownership of various industries and tightly control the decisions made in other industries that were allowed to remain privately owned. Wide sections of the political, intellectual, and even business communities have often been in favor of this expansive role of government. During the 1980s, however, the tide began to turn the other way, toward reducing the role of government. This happened first in Britain and the United States. Then such trends spread rapidly through the democratic countries, and even communist China began to let markets operate more freely. The collapse of communism in the Soviet bloc led to market economies emerging in Eastern Europe as well. As a 1998 study put it, all around the globe, socialists are embracing capitalism. Governments are selling off companies they had previously nationalized, and countries are seeking to entice back multinational corporations that they had expelled just two decades earlier. Experience, often bitter experience, had more to do with such changes than any new theory or analysis. Despite the wide range of functions which governments can engage in and have engaged in, here we can examine the basic functions of government that virtually everyone can agree on and explain why those functions are important for the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. One of the most basic functions of government is to provide a framework of law and order within which the people can engage in whatever economic and other activities they choose, making such mutual accommodations and agreements among themselves as they see fit. There are also certain activities which generate significant costs or benefits that extend beyond those individuals who engage in those activities. Here, government can take account of such costs and benefits when the marketplace does not. The individuals who work for government in various capacities tend to respond to the incentives facing them, just as people do in corporations, in families, and in other human institutions and activities. Government is neither a monolith nor simply the public interest personified. To understand what it does, its incentives and constraints must be taken into account, just as the incentives and constraints of the marketplace must be for those who engage in market transactions. Law and order. Where government restricts its economic role to that of an enforcer of laws and contracts, some people say that such a policy amounts to doing nothing as far as the economy is concerned. However, what is called nothing has often taken centuries to achieve, namely, a reliable framework of laws within which economic activity can flourish, and without which even vast amounts of rich natural resources may fail to be developed into a corresponding level of output and resulting prosperity. Corruption. Like the role of prices, the role of a reliable framework of laws may be easier to understand by observing what happens in times and places where such a framework does not exist. Countries whose governments are ineffectual, arbitrary, or thoroughly corrupt can remain poor despite an abundance of natural resources, because neither foreign nor domestic entrepreneurs want to risk the kinds of large investments which are required to develop natural resources into finished products that raise the general standard of living. A classic example is the African nation of Congo, rich in minerals but poor in every other way. Here is the scene encountered at the airport in its capital city of Kinshasa. Kinshasa is one of the world's poorest cities, so unsafe for arriving crews that they get shuttled elsewhere for overnight stays. Taxiing down the scarred tarmac feels like driving over railroad ties. Managers charge extra to turn on the runway lights at night, and departing passengers can encounter several layers of bribes before boarding. Bolivia is another third world country where law and order have broken down. The media are full of revelations about police links to drug trafficking and stolen vehicles, nepotism in the force, and the charging of illegal fees for services. Officers on meager salaries have been found to live in mansions. In Egypt, when a rich and politically well-connected businessman was sentenced to death for hiring a hitman to kill a former lover, people were astounded and pleased, according to the New York Times, because he was a high roller of the type that Egyptians have long assumed to operate beyond the reach of the law. Whatever the merits or demerits of particular laws, someone must administer those laws, and how efficiently or how honestly that is done can make a huge economic difference. The phrase, "the law's delay," goes back at least as far as Shakespeare's time. Such delay imposes costs on those whose investments are idled, whose shipments are held up, and whose ability to plan their economic activities is crippled by red tape and slow-moving bureaucrats. Moreover, bureaucrats' ability to create delay often means an opportunity for them to collect bribes to speed things up, all of which adds up to higher costs of doing business. That, in turn, means higher prices to consumers and correspondingly lower standards of living for the country as a whole. The costs of corruption are not limited to the bribes collected, since these are internal transfers, rather than net reductions of national wealth in themselves. Because scarce resources have alternative uses, the real costs are the foregone alternatives, delayed or aborted economic activity, the enterprises that are not started, the investments that are not made, the expansion of output and employment that does not take place in a thoroughly corrupt society, as well as the loss of skilled, educated, and entrepreneurial people who leave the country. As The Economist magazine put it, "For sound economic reasons, foreign investors and international aid agencies are increasingly taking the level of bribery and corruption into account in their investment and lending." A study by the World Bank concluded, "Across countries, there is strong evidence that higher levels of corruption are associated with lower growth and lower levels of per capita income. The three countries ranked most corrupt were Haiti, Bangladesh, and Nigeria, all poverty-stricken beyond anything seen in modern industrial societies. During Tsarist Russia's industrialization in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, one of the country's biggest handicaps was the widespread corruption in the general population, in addition to the corruption that was rampant within the Russian government. Foreign firms that hired Russian workers, and even Russian executives, made it a point not to hire Russian accountants. This corruption continued under the communists and has become an international scandal in the post-communist era. One study pointed out that the stock of a Russian oil company sold for about 1% of what the stock of a similar oil company would sell for in the United States, because the market expects that Russian oil companies will be systematically looted by insiders. Similar corruption was common in Russian universities, according to the Chronicle of Higher Education's Moscow correspondent. It costs between $10,000 and $15,000 in bribes merely to gain acceptance into well-regarded institutions of higher learning in Moscow, the daily newspaper Izvestia has reported. At Astrakhan State Technical University, about 700 miles south of Moscow, three professors were arrested after allegedly inducing students to pay cash to ensure good grades on exams. Overall, Russian students and their parents annually spend at least $2 billion, and possibly up to $5 billion, in such unofficial educational outlays, the Deputy Prime Minister, Valentina Matvienko, said last year in an interview. Corruption can, of course, take many forms besides the direct bribe. It can, for example, take the form of appointing politicians or their relatives to a company's board of directors in expectation of receiving more favorable treatment from the government. This practice varies from country to country, like more overt corruption. As The Economist put it, politically linked firms are most common in countries famous for high levels of corruption. Russia has led the way in this practice, in which firms with 80% of the country's market capitalization were linked to public officials. The comparable figure for the United States was less than 10%, partly due to American laws restricting this practice. Widespread corruption is not something new in Russia. John Stuart Mill wrote about it in the 19th century. The universal venality ascribed to Russian functionaries must be an immense drag on the capabilities of economical improvement possessed so abundantly by the Russian Empire, since the emoluments of public officers must depend on the success with which they can multiply vexations for the purpose of being bought off by bribes. It is not just corruption, but also sheer bureaucracy which can stifle economic activity. Even one of India's most spectacularly successful industrialists, Aditya Birla, found himself forced to look to other countries in which to expand his investments because of India's slow-moving bureaucrats. With all his successes, there were heartbreaks galore. One of them was the Mangalore refinery, which Delhi's bureaucrats took 11 years to clear, a record even by the standards of the Indian bureaucracy. While both of us were waiting for a court to open up at the Bombay Gymkhana one day, I asked Aditya Birla what had led him to invest abroad. He had no choice, he said, in his deep, unaffected voice. There were too many obstacles in India. To begin with, he needed a license, which the government would not give because the Birlas were classified as a large house under the MRTP, Monopolies and Restrictive Trade Practices Act. Even if he did get one miraculously, the government would decide where he should invest, what technology he must use, what was to be the size of his plant, how it was to be financed, even the size and structure of his public issue. Then he would have to battle the bureaucracy to get licenses for the import of capital goods and raw materials. After that, he faced dozens of clearances at the state level for power, land, sales tax, excise, labor, among others. All this takes years, and frankly, I get exhausted just thinking about it. This head of 37 companies with combined sales in the billions of dollars, someone capable of creating many much-needed jobs in India, ended up producing fiber in Thailand, which was converted to yarn in his factory in Indonesia, after which this yarn was sent to Belgium, where it was woven into carpets, which were then exported to Canada. All the jobs, incomes, auxiliary business opportunities, and taxes from which India could have benefited were lost because of the country's own bureaucracies. India is not unique, either in government-created business delays or in their negative economic consequences. A survey by the World Bank found that the number of days required to start a new business ranged from less than 10 in prosperous Singapore to 155 days in poverty-stricken Congo. The framework of laws. For fostering economic activities and the prosperity resulting from them, laws must be reliable above all. If the application of the law varies with the whims of kings or dictators, with changes in democratically elected governments, or with the caprices or corruption of appointed officials, then the risks surrounding investments rise, and consequently, the amount of investing is likely to be much less than purely economic considerations would produce in a market economy under a reliable framework of laws. One of the major advantages that enabled 19th century Britain to become the first industrialized nation was the dependability of its laws. Not only could Britons feel confident when investing in their country's economy without fear that their earnings would be confiscated or dissipated in bribes, or that the contracts they made would be changed or voided for political reasons, so could foreigners doing business in Britain or making investments there. For centuries, the reputation of British law for dependability and impartiality attracted investments and entrepreneurs from continental Europe, as well as skilled immigrants and refugees who helped create whole new industries in Britain. In short, both the physical capital and the human capital of foreigners, contributed to the development of the British economy from the medieval era, where it was one of the more backward economies in Western Europe, to a later era when it became the most advanced economy in the world, setting the stage for Britain's Industrial Revolution that led the rest of the world into the Industrial Age. In other parts of the world as well, a framework of dependable laws has encouraged both domestic and foreign investment, as well as attracting immigrants with skills lacking locally. In Southeast Asia, for example, the imposition of European laws under the colonial regimes of the 18th and 19th centuries replaced the powers of local rulers and tribes. Under these new frameworks of laws, often uniform across larger geographical areas than before, as well as being more dependable at a given place, a massive immigration from China and a substantial immigration from India brought in people whose skills and entrepreneurship created whole new industries and transformed the economies of countries throughout the region. European investors also sent capital to Southeast Asia, financing many of the giant ventures in mining and shipping that were often beyond the resources of the Chinese and Indian immigrants, as well as beyond the resources of the indigenous peoples. In colonial Malaya, for example, the tin mines and rubber plantations, which provided much of that country's export earnings, were financed by European capital and worked by laborers from China and India, while most local commerce and industry were in the hands of the Chinese, leaving the indigenous Malays largely spectators at the modernization of their own economy. While impartiality is a desirable quality in laws, even laws which are discriminatory can still promote economic development if the nature of the discrimination is spelled out in advance, rather than taking the form of unpredictably biased and corrupt decisions by judges, juries, and officials. The Chinese and Indians who settled in the European colonial empires of Southeast Asia never had the same legal rights as Europeans there, nor the same rights as the indigenous population. Yet whatever rights they did have could be relied upon, and therefore served as a foundation for the creation of Chinese and Indian businesses throughout the region. Similarly, in the Ottoman Empire, Christians and Jews did not have the same rights as Muslims. Yet, during the flourishing centuries of that empire, the rights which Christians and Jews did have were sufficiently dependable to enable them to prosper in commerce, industry, and banking to a greater extent than the Muslim majority. Moreover, their economic activities contributed to the prosperity of the Ottoman Empire as a whole. Similar stories could be told of the Lebanese minority in colonial West Africa or Indians in colonial Fiji, as well as other minority groups in other countries who prospered under laws that were dependable, even if not impartial. Dependability is not simply a matter of the government's own treatment of people. It must also prevent some people from interfering with other people, so that criminals and mobs do not make economic life risky and thereby stifle the economic development required for prosperity. Governments differ in the effectiveness with which they can enforce their laws in general, and even a given government may be able to enforce its laws more effectively in some places than in others. For centuries during the Middle Ages, the borderlands between English and Scottish kingdoms were not effectively controlled by either country, and so remained lawless and economically backward. Mountainous regions have often been difficult to police, whether in the Balkans, the Appalachian region of the United States, or elsewhere. Such places have likewise tended to lag in economic development and to attract few outsiders and little outside capital. Today, high crime neighborhoods and neighborhoods subject to higher than normal rates of vandalism or riots similarly suffer economically from a lack of law and order. Some businesses simply will not locate there. Those that do may be less efficient or less pleasant than businesses in other neighborhoods, where such substandard businesses would be unable to compete. The costs of additional security devices inside and outside of stores, as well as security guards in some places, all add to the costs of doing business and are reflected in the higher prices of goods and services purchased by people in high crime areas, even though most people in such areas are not criminals and can ill afford the extra costs created by those who are. Property rights. Among the most misunderstood aspects of law and order are property rights. While these rights are cherished as personal benefits by those fortunate enough to own a substantial amount of property, what matters from the standpoint of economics is how property rights affect the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. What property rights mean to property owners is far less important than what they mean to the economy as a whole. In other words, property rights need to be assessed in terms of their economic effects on the well-being of the population at large. These effects are ultimately an empirical question which cannot be settled on the basis of assumptions or rhetoric. What is different with and without property rights? One small but telling example was the experience of a delegation of American farmers who visited the Soviet Union. They were appalled at the way various agricultural produce was shipped, carelessly packed, and with spoiled fruit or vegetables left to spread the spoilage to other fruits and vegetables in the same sacks or boxes. Coming from a country where individuals owned agricultural produce as their private property, American farmers had no experience with such gross carelessness and waste, which would have caused somebody to lose much money needlessly in the United States and perhaps go bankrupt. In the Soviet Union, the loss was even more painful, since the country often had trouble feeding itself, but there were no property rights to convey these losses directly to the people handling and shipping produce. In a country without property rights, or with the food being owned by the people, there was no given individual with sufficient incentives to ensure that this food did not spoil needlessly before it reached the consumers. Those who handled the food in transit were paid salaries, which were fixed independently of how well they did or did not safeguard the food. In theory, at least, closer monitoring of produce handlers could have reduced the spoilage, but monitoring is not free. The human resources which go into monitoring are themselves among the scarce resources which have alternative uses. Moreover, monitoring raises the further question, who will monitor the monitors? The Soviets tried to deal with this problem by having Communist Party members honeycombed throughout the society to report on derelictions of duty and violations of law. However, the widespread corruption and inefficiency found even under Stalinist totalitarianism suggest the limitations of official monitoring, as compared to automatic self-monitoring by property owners. No monitor has to stand over an American farmer and tell him to take the rotten peaches out of a basket before they spoil the others, because those peaches are his private property, and he is not about to lose money if he doesn't have to. Property rights create self-monitoring, which tends to be both more effective and less costly than third-party monitoring. Most Americans do not own any agricultural land or crops, but they have more and better food available at more affordable prices than in countries where there are no property rights in agricultural land or its produce, and where much food can spoil needlessly as a result. Since the prices paid for the food that is sold have to cover the costs of all the food produced, including the food that was spoiled and discarded, food prices will be higher where there is more spoilage, even if the cost of producing the food in the first place is the same. The only animals threatened with extinction are animals not owned by anybody. Colonel Sanders was not about to let chickens become extinct, nor will McDonald's stand idly by and let cows become extinct. Likewise with inanimate things, it is those things not owned by anybody, air and water, for example, which are polluted. In centuries past, sheep were allowed to graze on unowned land, the commons as it was called, with the net result that land on the commons was so heavily grazed that it had little left but patchy ground, and the shepherds had hungry and scrawny sheep. But privately owned land adjacent to the commons was usually in far better condition. Similar neglect of unowned land occurred in the Soviet Union. According to Soviet economists, forested areas that are cut down are not reseeded, though it would be financial suicide for a lumbering company to let that happen on their own property in a capitalist economy. All these things illustrate, in different ways, the value of private property rights to the society as a whole, including people who own virtually no private property, but who benefit from the greater economic efficiency that property rights create, which translates into a higher standard of living for the population at large. Despite a tendency to think of property rights as special privileges for the rich, many property rights are actually more valuable to people who are not rich, and such property rights have often been infringed or violated for the benefit of the rich. Although the average rich person, by definition, has more money than the average person who is not rich, in the aggregate, the non-rich population often has far more money. This means, among other things, that many properties owned by the rich would be bid away from them by the greater purchasing power of the non-rich, if unrestricted property rights prevailed in a free market. Thus, land occupied by mansions located on huge estates can pass through the market to entrepreneurs who build smaller and more numerous homes or apartment buildings on these sites, all for the use of people with more modest incomes, but with more money in the aggregate. Someone once said, "It doesn't matter whether you are rich or poor, so long as you have money." This was meant as a joke, but it has very serious implications. In a free market, the money of ordinary people is just as good as the money of the rich, and in the aggregate, there is often more of it. The individually less affluent need not directly bid against the more affluent. Entrepreneurs or their companies, using their own money or money borrowed from banks and other financial institutions, can acquire mansions and estates and replace them with middle-class homes and apartment buildings for people of moderate incomes. This would, of course, change these communities in ways the rich might not like, however much others might like to live in the resulting newly developed communities. Wealthy people have often forestalled such transfers of property by getting laws passed to restrict property rights in a variety of ways. For example, various affluent communities in California, Virginia, and other places have required land to be sold only in lots of 1 acre or more per house, thereby pricing such land and homes beyond the reach of most people, and thus neutralizing the greater aggregate purchasing power of less affluent people. Zoning boards, open space laws, historical preservation commissions, and other organizations and devices have also been used to severely limit the sale of private property for use in ways not approved by those who wish to keep things the way they are in the communities where they live, often described as our community, though no one owns the whole community, and each individual owns only that individual's private property. Yet such verbal collectivization is more than just a figure of speech. Often it is a prelude to legal and political actions to negate private property rights and treat the whole community as if it were in fact collectively owned. By infringing or negating property rights, affluent and wealthy property owners are thus able to keep out people of average or low incomes, and at the same time increase the value of their own property by ensuring its growing scarcity as population increases in the area. While strict adherence to property rights would allow landlords to evict tenants from their apartments at will, the economic incentives are for landlords to do just the opposite, that is, to try to keep their apartments as fully rented and as continuously occupied as possible, so long as the tenants pay their rent and create no problems. Only when rent control or other restrictions on their property rights are enacted are landlords likely to do otherwise. Under rent control and tenants' rights laws, landlords have been known to try to arrest tenants into leaving, whether in New York or in Hong Kong. Under stringent rent control and tenants' rights laws in Hong Kong, landlords were known to sneak into their own buildings late at night to vandalize the premises in order to make them less attractive or even unlivable, so that tenants would move out and the empty building could then be torn down legally to be replaced by something more lucrative as commercial or industrial property, not subject to rent control laws. This, of course, was by no means the purpose or intention of those who had passed rent control laws in Hong Kong, but it illustrates again the importance of making a distinction between intentions and effects, and not just as regards property rights laws. In short, incentives matter, and property rights need to be assessed economically in terms of the incentives created by their existence, their modifications, or their elimination. The powerful incentives created by a profit and loss economy depend on the profits being private property. When government-owned enterprises in the Soviet Union made profits, those profits were not their private property, but belonged to the people, or in more mundane terms, could be taken by the government for whatever purposes higher officials chose to spend them on. Soviet economists Shmilev and Popov pointed out and lamented the adverse effects of this on incentives. But what justifies confiscating the larger part, sometimes 90 to 95%, of enterprises' profits, as is being done in many sectors of the economy today. What political or economic right, ultimately what human right, do ministries have to do that? Once again, we are taking away from those who work well in order to keep afloat those who do nothing. How can we possibly talk about independence, initiative, rewards for efficiency, quality, and technical progress? Of course, the country's leaders could continue to talk about such things, but destroying the incentives which exist under property rights meant that there was a reduced chance of achieving these goals. Because of an absence of property rights, those who ran enterprises that made profits can't buy or build anything with the money they have, which represent just figures in a bank account with no real value whatever without permission from above to use that money. In other words, success did not automatically lead to expansions of successful enterprises, nor failure to the contraction of unsuccessful ones, as it does in a market economy. Social order. Order includes more than laws and the government apparatus that administers laws. It also includes the honesty, reliability, and cooperativeness of the people themselves. Morality plays a functional role in the operation of the economic system, as Nobel Prize-winning economist Kenneth Arrow put it. Honesty and reliability can vary greatly between one country and another. As a knowledgeable observer put it, while it is unimaginable to do business in China without paying bribes, to offer one in Japan is the greatest of faux pas. Losses from shoplifting and employee theft, as a percentage of sales, have been more than twice as high in India as in Germany or Taiwan. When wallets with money in them were deliberately left in public places as an experiment, the percentage of those wallets returned with the money untouched varied greatly from place to place. In Denmark, for example, nearly all of these wallets were returned with the money still in them. Among United Nations representatives who have diplomatic immunity from local laws in New York City, diplomats from various Middle East countries let numerous parking tickets go unpaid, 246 by Kuwaiti diplomats, while not one diplomat from Denmark, Japan, or Israel had any unpaid parking tickets. Honesty and reliability can also vary widely among particular groups within a given country, and that also has economic repercussions. Some insular groups rely upon their own internal social controls for doing business with fellow group members whom they can trust. The Marwaris of India are one such group, whose business networks were established in the 19th century and extended beyond India to China and Central Asia, and who transacted vast sums merely on the merchant's word. But for India as a whole, that is definitely not the case. Business transactions among strangers are an essential part of a successful modern mass economy, which requires cooperation, including the pooling of vast financial resources from far more people than can possibly know each other personally. As for the general level of reliability among strangers in India, the Economist reported, "If you withdraw 10,000 rupees from a bank, it will probably come in a brick of 100 rupee notes held together by industrial-strength staples that you struggle to prize open. They are there to stop someone from surreptitiously removing a few notes. On trains, announcements may advise you to crush your empty mineral water bottles, lest someone refill them with tap water and sell them as new. Any sort of business that requires confidence in the judicial system is best left alone." Where neither the honesty of the general population nor the integrity of the legal system can be relied upon, economic activities are inhibited, if not stifled. At the same time, particular groups whose members can rely on each other, such as the Marwaris, have a great advantage in competition with others, in being able to secure mutual cooperation in economic activities which extend over distance and time, activities that would be far more risky for others in such societies, and still more so for foreigners. Like the Marwaris in India, Hasidic Jews in New York's Diamond District often give consignments of jewels to one another and share the sales proceeds on the basis of verbal agreements among themselves. The extreme social isolation of the Hasidic community from the larger society, and even from other Jews, makes it very costly for anyone who grows up in that community to disgrace his family and lose his own standing, as well as his own economic and social relationships, by cheating on an agreement with a fellow Hasidim. It is much the same story halfway around the world. where the overseas Chinese minority in various Southeast Asian countries make verbal agreements among themselves without the sanction of the local legal system. Given the unreliability and corruption of some of these post-colonial legal systems, the ability of the Chinese to rely on their own social and economic arrangements gives them an economic advantage over their indigenous competitors, who lack an equally reliable and inexpensive way of making transactions or pooling their money safely. The costs of doing business are thus less for the Chinese than for Malay, Indonesian, or other businesses in the region, giving the Chinese competitive advantages. What economics professor William Easterly of New York University has aptly called the radius of trust extends for very different distances among different groups and nations. For some, it extends no further than the family. Malagasy grain traders carry out inspections of each lot of grain in person because they don't trust employees. 1/3 of the traders say they don't hire more workers because of fear of theft by them. This limits the grain trader's firm size, cutting short a trader's potential success. In many countries, companies tend to be family enterprises because family members are the only ones felt trustworthy. So the size of the company is then limited by the size of the family. Even in the same country, the radius of trust can extend very different distances. Although businesses in some American communities must incur the extra expenses of heavy grates for protection from theft and vandalism while closed, and security guards for protection while open, businesses in other American communities have no such expenses and are therefore able to operate profitably while charging lower prices. Rental car companies can park their cars in lots without fences or guards in some communities, while in other places it would be financial suicide to do so. But in those places where car thefts from unguarded lots are rare, such rare losses may cost less than paying guards and maintaining fences would cost, so that rental car agencies and other businesses can flourish as they operate at lower costs in such communities. Those communities also flourish economically, as a result of attracting enterprises and investments that create jobs and pay local taxes. In short, honesty is more than a moral principle, it is also a major economic factor. While government can do little to create honesty directly, in various ways it can indirectly either support or undermine the traditions on which honest conduct is based. This it can do by what it teaches in its schools, by the examples set by public officials, or by the laws that it passes. These laws can create incentives toward either moral or immoral conduct. Where laws create a situation in which the only way to avoid ruinous losses is by violating the law, the government is in effect reducing public respect for laws in general, as well as rewarding specific dishonest behavior. Advocates of rent control, for example, often point to examples of dishonest behavior among landlords to demonstrate an apparent need for both rent control itself and for related tenants' rights legislation. However, rent control laws can widen the difference between the value of a given apartment building to honest owners and dishonest owners. Where the costs of legally mandated services, such as heat, maintenance, and hot water, are high enough to equal or exceed the amount of rent permitted under the law, the value of a building to an honest landlord can become zero or even negative. Yet, to a landlord who is willing to violate the law and save money by neglecting required services, or who accepts bribes from prospective tenants during a housing shortage under rent control, the building may still have some value. Where something has different values to different people, it tends to move through the marketplace to its most valued use, which is where the bids will be highest. In this case, dishonest landlords can easily bid apartment buildings away from honest landlords, some of whom may be relieved to escape the bind that rent control puts them in. Landlords willing to resort to arson may find the building most valuable of all, if they can sell the site for commercial or industrial use after burning the building down, thereby getting rid of both tenants and rent control. As one study found, in New York City, landlord arsons became so common in some areas that the city responded with special welfare allowances. For a while, burned-out tenants were moved to the top of the list for coveted public housing. That gave tenants an incentive to burn down their buildings. They did, often moving television sets and furniture out onto the sidewalk before starting the fire. Those who create incentives toward widespread dishonesty by promoting laws which make honest behavior financially impossible are often among the most indignant at the dishonesty, and the least likely to regard themselves as in any way responsible for it. Arson is just one of the forms of dishonesty promoted by rent control laws. Shrewd and unscrupulous landlords have made virtually a science out of milking a rent-controlled building by neglecting maintenance and repairs, defaulting on mortgage payments, falling behind in the payment of taxes, and then finally letting the building become the property of the city by default. Then they move on to repeat the same destructive process with other rent-controlled buildings. Without rent control, the incentives facing landlords are directly opposite. In the absence of rent control, the incentives are to maintain the quality of the property in order to attract tenants, and to safeguard it against fire and other sources of danger to the survival of the building, which is a valuable piece of property to them in a free market. In short, complaints against landlords' behavior by rent control advocates can be valid, even though few of those advocates see any connection between rent control and a declining moral quality in people who become landlords. When honest landlords stand to lose money under rent control, while dishonest landlords can still make a profit, it is virtually inevitable that the property will pass from the former to the latter. Rent control laws are just one of a number of severe restrictions which can make honest behavior too costly for many people, and which therefore promote widespread dishonesty. It is common in third world countries for much, sometimes most, economic activity to take place off the books, which is to say, illegally, because oppressive levels of bureaucracy and red tape make legal operation too costly for most people to afford. In the African nation of Cameroon, for example, setting up a small business has required paying official fees, not counting bribes, that amount to far more money than the average person in Cameroon makes in a year. The legal system imposes similarly high costs on other economic activities. To buy or sell property costs nearly a fifth of the property's value. To get the courts to enforce an unpaid invoice takes nearly 2 years, costs over a third of the invoice's value, and requires 58 separate procedures. These ridiculous regulations are good news for the bureaucrats who enforce them. Every procedure is an opportunity to extract a bribe. When laws and policies make honesty increasingly costly, then government is, in effect, promoting dishonesty. Such dishonesty can then extend beyond the particular laws and policies in question to a more general habit of disobeying laws, to the detriment of the whole economy and society. As a Russian mother said, "Now my children tell me I raised them the wrong way. All that honesty and fairness, no one needs it now. If you are honest, you are a fool." To the extent that such attitudes are widespread in any given country, the consequences are economic as well as social. Despite all the countries which have seen their economic growth rates rise sharply when they went from government-controlled economies to free market economies, Russia saw its output and its standard of living fall precipitously after the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the conversion of state-owned property into property owned by former communist leaders turned capitalists. Rampant corruption can negate the benefits of markets, as it negates the benefits of a rich endowment of natural resources or a highly educated population. While a market economy operates better in a country where honesty is more widespread, it is also true that free markets tend to punish dishonesty. American investigative journalist John Stossel, who began his career by exposing various kinds of frauds that businesses commit against consumers, found this pattern. "I did hundreds of stories on such scams, but over the years, I came to realize that in the private sector, the cheaters seldom get very rich. It's not because consumer fraud investigators catch them and stop them. Most fraud never even gets on the government's radar screens. The cheaters get punished by the market. They make money for a while, but then people wise up and stop buying." There are exceptions. In a multi-trillion-dollar economy with tens of thousands of businesses, there will always be some successful cheaters and Enron-like scams. But the longer I did consumer reporting, the harder it was for us to find serious ripoffs worthy of national television. Levels of government corruption not only vary greatly among nations, they can vary over time with the same nations. Corrupting an honest government may be easier than trying to change a corrupt way of life into an honest one. but even the latter can be done sometimes. Reporting on economic progress in Africa in 2013, The Economist magazine said, "Our correspondent visited 23 countries and was not once asked for a bribe, inconceivable only 10 years ago." External costs and benefits. Economic decisions made through the marketplace are not always better than decisions that governments can make. Much depends on whether those market transactions accurately reflect both the costs and the benefits that result. Under some conditions, they do not. When someone buys a table or a tractor, the question as to whether it is worth what it cost is answered by the actions of the purchaser who made the decision to buy it. However, when an electric utility company buys coal to burn to generate electricity, a significant part of the cost of the electricity generating process is paid by people who breathe the smoke that results from the burning of the coal and whose homes and cars are dirtied by the soot. Cleaning, repainting, and medical costs paid by these people are not taken into account in the marketplace because these people do not participate in the transactions between the coal producer and the utility company. Such costs are called external costs by economists because such costs fall outside the parties to the transaction which creates these costs. External costs are therefore not taken into account in the marketplace, even when these are very substantial costs, which can extend beyond monetary losses to include bad health and premature death. While there are many decisions that can be made more efficiently through the marketplace than by government, this is one of those decisions that can be made more efficiently by government than by the marketplace. Even such a champion of free markets as Milton Friedman acknowledged that there are effects on third parties for which it is not feasible to charge or recompense them. Clean air laws can reduce harmful emissions by legislation and regulations. Clean water laws and laws against disposing of toxic wastes where they will harm people can likewise force decisions to be made in ways that take into account the external costs that would otherwise be ignored by those transacting in the marketplace. By the same token, there may be transactions that would be beneficial to people who are not party to the decision-making and whose interests are therefore not taken into account. The benefits of mudflaps on cars and trucks may be apparent to anyone who has ever driven in a rainstorm behind a car or truck that was throwing so much water or mud onto his windshield as to dangerously obscure vision. Even if everyone agrees that the benefits of mudflaps greatly exceed their costs, there is no feasible way of buying these benefits in a free market, since you receive no benefits from the mudflaps that you buy and put on your own car, but only from mudflaps that other people buy and put on their cars and trucks. These are external benefits. Here again, it is possible to obtain collectively through government what cannot be obtained individually through the marketplace, simply by having laws passed requiring all cars and trucks to have mudflaps on them. Some other benefits are indivisible. Either everybody gets these kinds of benefits or nobody gets them. Military defense is an example. If military defense had to be purchased individually through the marketplace, then those who felt threatened by foreign powers could pay for guns, troops, cannon, and all the other means of military deterrence and defense, while those who saw no dangers could refuse to spend their money on such things. However, the level of military security would be the same for both, since supporters and non-supporters of military forces are intermixed in the same society and exposed to the same dangers from enemy action. Given the indivisibility of the benefits, even some citizens who fully appreciate the military dangers and who consider the costs of meeting those dangers to be fully justified by the benefits might still feel no need to voluntarily spend their own money for military purposes, since their individual contribution would have no serious effect on their own individual security, which would depend primarily on how much others contributed. In such a situation, it is entirely possible to end up with inadequate military defense, even if everyone understands the cost of effective defense and considers the benefits to be worth it. By collectivizing this decision and having it made by government, an end result can be achieved that is more in keeping with what most people want than if those people were allowed to decide individually what to do. Even among free market advocates, few would suggest that each individual should buy military defense in the marketplace. In short, There are things that government can do more efficiently than individuals because external costs, external benefits, or indivisibilities make individual decisions in the marketplace based on individual interests a less effective way of weighing costs and benefits to the whole society. While external costs and benefits are not automatically taken into account in the marketplace, this is not to say that there may not be some imaginative ways in which they can be. In Britain, for example, ponds or lakes are often privately owned, and these owners have every incentive to keep them from becoming polluted, since a clean body of water is more attractive to fishermen or boaters who pay for its use. Similarly, with shopping malls, although maintaining clean, attractive malls with benches, restrooms, and security personnel costs money that the mall owners do not collect from the shoppers, a mall with such things attracts more customers, and so the rents charged the individual store owners can be higher, because a location in such malls is more valuable than a location in a mall without such amenities. While there are some decisions which can be made more efficiently by individuals, and other decisions which can be made more efficiently through collective action, that collective action need not be that of a national or even a local government, but can be that of individuals spontaneously organizing themselves to deal with external costs or external benefits. For example, back during the pioneering days in the American West, when cattle grazed on the open plains that were not owned by anyone, there was the same danger that more animals would be allowed to graze than the land would support, as with sheep on the commons, since no given cattle owner had an incentive to restrict the number of his own animals that were allowed to graze. In the American West during the pioneering era, owners of cattle organized themselves into cattlemen's associations that created rules for themselves and in one way or another kept newcomers out, in effect turning the plains into collectively owned land with collectively determined rules, sometimes enforced by collectively hired gunmen. Modern trade associations can sometimes make collective decisions for an industry more efficiently than individual business owners could, especially when there are externalities of the sort used to justify government intervention in market economies. Such private associations can promote the sharing of information and the standardization of products and procedures, benefiting both themselves and their customers. Railroads can get together and standardize the gauges of their tracks so that trains can transfer from one line to another, or hotels can standardize their room reservation procedures in order to make travel reservations for their guests who are traveling on to another community. In short, while externalities are a serious consideration in determining the role of government, they do not simply provide a blanket justification or a magic word which automatically allows economics to be ignored and politically attractive goals to be pursued without further ado. Both the incentives of the market and the incentives of politics must be weighed when choosing between them on any particular issue. Incentives and constraints. Government is, of course, inseparable from politics, especially in a democratic country, so a distinction must be made and constantly kept in mind between what a government can do to make things better than they would be in a free market and what it is, in fact, likely to do under the influence of political incentives and constraints. The distinction between what the government can do and what it is likely to do can be lost when we think of the government as simply an agent of society or even as one integral performer. In reality, the many individuals and agencies within a national government have their own separate interests, incentives, and agendas, to which they may respond far more often than they respond to either the public interest or to the policy agendas set by political leaders. Even in a totalitarian state such as the Soviet Union, different branches and departments of government had different interests that they pursued, despite whatever disadvantages this might have for the economy or the society. For example, industrial enterprises in different ministries avoided relying on each other for equipment or supplies, if at all possible. Thus, an enterprise located in Vladivostok might order equipment or supplies that it needed from another enterprise under the same ministry located in Minsk, thousands of miles away, rather than depend on getting what it needed from another enterprise located nearby in Vladivostok that was under the control of a different ministry. Thus, materials might be needlessly shipped thousands of miles eastward on the overburdened Soviet railroads, while the same kinds of materials were also being shipped westward on the same railroads by another enterprise under a different ministry. Such economically wasteful cross-hauling was one of many inefficient allocations of scarce resources due to the political reality that government is not a monolith, even in a totalitarian society. In democratic societies, where innumerable interest groups are free to organize and influence different branches and agencies of government, there is even less reason to expect that the entire government will follow one coherent policy, much less a policy that would be followed by an ideal government representing the public interest. In the United States, some government agencies have been trying to restrict smoking, while other government agencies have been subsidizing the growing of tobacco. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan once referred to the warring principalities that are sometimes known as the federal government. Under popularly elected government, the political incentives are to do what is popular, even if the consequences are worse than the consequences of doing nothing or doing something that is less popular. As an example of what virtually everyone now agrees was a counterproductive policy, the Nixon administration in 1971 created the first peacetime nationwide wage controls and price controls in the history of the United States. Among those at the meeting where this fateful decision was made was internationally renowned economist Arthur F. Burns, who argued strenuously against the policy being considered and was overruled. Nor were the other people present economically illiterate. The president himself had long resisted the idea of wage and price controls and had publicly rejected the idea just 11 days before doing an about-face and accepting it. Inflation had created mounting pressures from the public and the media to do something. With a presidential election due the following year, the administration could not afford to be seen as doing nothing while inflation raged out of control. However, even aside from such political concerns, the participants in this meeting were exhilarated by all the great decisions they had made that day, according to a participant. Looking back, he later recalled that more time was spent discussing the timing of the speech than how the economic program would work. There was particular concern that if the president's speech were broadcast in prime time, it would cause cancellation of the very popular television program Bonanza, leading to public resentments. Here is what happened. Nixon's speech, despite the preemption of Bonanza, was a great hit. The public felt that the government was coming to its defense against the price gougers. During the next evening's newscasts, 90% of the coverage was devoted to Nixon's new policy. The coverage was favorable, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average registered a 32.9-point gain, the largest one-day increase up to then. In short, the controls were a complete success politically. As for their economic consequences, ranchers stopped shipping their cattle to the market, farmers drowned their chickens, and consumers emptied the shelves of supermarkets. In short, artificially low prices led to supplies being reduced, while the quantity demanded by consumers increased. For example, more American cattle began to be exported, mostly to Canada, instead of being sold in the price-controlled U.S. market. Thus, price controls produced essentially the same results under the Nixon administration as they had produced in the Roman Empire under Diocletian, in Russia under the Communists, in Ghana under Nkrumah, and in numerous other times and places where such policies had been tried before. Nor was this particular policy unique politically in how it was conceived and carried out. Veteran economic advisor Herbert Stein observed, 25 years after the Nixon administration meeting at which he had been present, "Failure to look ahead is extremely common in government policy making." Another way of saying the same thing is that political time horizons tend to be much shorter than economic time horizons. Before the full negative economic consequences of the wage and price control policies became widely apparent, Nixon had been reelected with a landslide victory at the polls. There is no present value factor to force political decision makers to take into account the long-run consequences of their current decisions. One of the important fields neglected as a result of the short political time horizon is education. As a writer in India put it, "No one bothers about education because results take a long time to come." This is not peculiar to India. With fundamental educational reform being both difficult and requiring years to show end results and a better educated population entering adulthood, it is politically much more expedient for elected officials to demonstrate immediate concern for education by voting to spend increasing amounts of the taxpayers' money on it, even if that leads only to more expensive incompetence in more showy buildings. The constraints within which government policymaking operates are as important as the incentives. Important and beneficial as a framework of rules of law may be, what that also means is that many matters must be dealt with categorically, rather than incrementally, as in a market economy. The application of categorical laws prevents the enormous powers of government from being applied at the discretion or whim of individual bureaucratic functionaries, which would invite both corruption and arbitrary oppression. Since there are many things which require discretionary incremental adjustments, as noted in Chapter 4, for these things, categorical laws can be difficult to apply or can produce counterproductive results. For example, while prevention of air pollution and water pollution are widely recognized as legitimate functions of government, which can achieve more economically efficient results in this regard than those of the free market, doing so through categorical laws can create major problems. Despite the political appeal of categorical phrases like clean water and clean air, there are, in fact, no such things, never have been, and perhaps never will be. Moreover, there are diminishing returns in removing impurities from water or air. Reducing truly dangerous amounts of impurities from water or air may be done at costs that most people would agree were quite reasonable. But as higher and higher standards of purity are prescribed by government, in order to eliminate ever more minute traces of ever more remote or more questionable dangers, the costs escalate out of proportion to the benefits. Even if removing 98% of a given impurity costs twice as much as eliminating 97%, and removing 99% costs 10 times as much, the political appeal of categorical phrases like clean water may be just as potent when the water is already 99% pure as when it was dangerously polluted. That was demonstrated back in the 1970s. The Council of Economic Advisers argued that making the nation's streams 99% pure rather than 98% pure would have a cost far exceeding its benefits, but Congress was unmoved. Depending on what the particular impurity is, minute traces may or may not pose a serious danger. But political controversies over impurities in the water are unlikely to be settled at a scientific level when passions can be whipped up in the name of non-existent clean water. No matter how pure the water becomes, someone can always demand the removal of more impurities. And unless the public understands the logical and economic implications of what is being said, that demand can become politically irresistible, since no public official wants to be known as being opposed to clean water. It is not even certain that reducing extremely small amounts of substances that are harmful in larger amounts reduces risks at all. Even arsenic in the water, in extremely minute traces, has been found to have health benefits. An old saying declares, "It is the dose that makes the poison." Similar research findings apply to many substances, including saccharin and alcohol. Although high doses of saccharin have been shown to increase the rate of cancer in laboratory rats, very low doses seem to reduce the rate of cancer in these rats. Although a large intake of alcohol shortens people's lifespans in many ways, very modest amounts of alcohol, like one glass of wine or beer per day, tend to reduce life-threatening conditions like hypertension. If there is some threshold amount of a particular substance required before it becomes harmful, that makes it questionable whether spending vast amounts of money to try to remove that last fraction of 1% from the air or water is necessarily going to make the public safer by even a minute amount. But what politician wants to be known as someone who blocked efforts to remove arsenic from water? The same principle applies in many other contexts, where minute traces of impurities can produce major political and legal battles and consume millions of tax dollars with little or no net effect on the health or safety of the public. For example, one legal battle raged for a decade over the impurities in a New Hampshire toxic waste site, where these wastes were so diluted that children could have eaten some of the dirt there for 70 days a year without any significant harm, if there had been any children living or playing there, which there were not. As a result of spending more than $9 million, the level of impurities was reduced to the point where children could have safely eaten the dirt there 245 days a year. Moreover, without anything being done at all, both parties to the litigation agreed that more than half the volatile impurities would have evaporated by the year 2000. Yet hypothetical dangers to hypothetical children kept the issue going and kept money being spent. With environmental safety, as with other kinds of safety, some forms of safety in one respect create dangers in other respects. California, for example, required a certain additive to be put into all gasoline sold in the state in order to reduce the air pollution from automobile exhaust fumes. However, this new additive tended to leak from filling station storage tanks and automobile gas tanks, polluting the groundwater in the first case and leading to more automobile fires in the second. Similarly, government-mandated airbags in automobiles, introduced to save lives in car crashes, have themselves killed small children. These are all matters of incremental trade-offs to find an optimal amount and kind of safety, in a world where being categorically safe is as impossible as achieving 100% clean air or clean water. Incremental trade-offs are made all the time in individual market transactions, but it can be politically suicidal to oppose demands for more clean air, clean water, or automobile safety. Therefore, saying that the government can improve over the results of individual transactions in a free market is not the same as saying that it will in fact do so. Among the greatest external costs imposed in a society can be those imposed politically by legislators and officials who pay no costs whatever, while imposing billions of dollars in costs on others, in order to respond to political pressures from advocates of particular interests or ideologies. In the United States, government regulations are estimated to cost about $7,800 per employee in large businesses and about $10,600 per employee in small businesses. Among other things, this suggests that the existence of numerous government regulations tends to give competitive advantages to big business, since they are apparently economies of scale in complying with these regulations. This is not peculiar to the United States. In some Islamic countries, getting lending practices to comply with the requirements of Islamic law can require more complex and more costly financial arrangements than in Western countries. However, once a financial institution in the Islamic world has had one of these legal documents created at great cost, that same document can be used innumerable times for similar transactions, far more often than a smaller business can, because the smaller business has fewer transactions. As The Economist magazine reported, financiers can recycle documentation rather than drawing it up from scratch. The contracts they now use for Sharia-compliant mortgages in America draw on templates originally drafted at great cost for aircraft leases. While government regulations may be defended by those who create them by referring to the benefits which such regulations provide, the economically relevant question is whether such benefits are worth the hundreds of billions of dollars in aggregate costs that they impose in the United States. In the marketplace, whoever creates $500 billion in costs will have to be sure to create more than $500 billion in benefits that customers will pay for. Otherwise, that producer would risk bankruptcy. In the government, however, there are seldom any incentives or constraints to force such comparisons. If any new government regulation can plausibly be claimed to solve some problem or create some benefit, then that is usually enough to permit government officials to go forward with that regulation. Since there are also some conceivable benefits that might be created from other government regulations and costs will be paid by the taxpayers, there are incentives to keep adding more regulations and few constraints on their growth. The number of pages in the Federal Register where government regulations are compiled almost always keeps increasing. One of the rare times when there was a reduction was during the Reagan administration in the 1980s. But after the Reagan administration was over, the increase in the number of pages in the Federal Register resumed. Just as we must keep in mind a sharp distinction between the goals of a particular policy and the actual consequences of that policy, so we must keep in mind a sharp distinction between the purpose for which a particular law was created and the purposes for which that law can be used. For example, President Franklin D. Roosevelt took the United States off the gold standard in 1933 under presidential powers created by laws passed during the First World War to prevent trading with enemy nations. Though that war had been over for more than a dozen years and the United States no longer had any enemy nations, the power was still there to be used for wholly different purposes. Powers do not expire when the crises that created them have passed. Nor does the repeal of old laws have a high priority among legislators. Still less are institutions likely to close up on their own when the circumstances that caused them to be created no longer exist. When thinking of government functions, we often assume that particular activities are best undertaken by government, rather than by non-governmental institutions, simply because that is the way those activities have been carried out in the past. The delivery of mail is an obvious example, yet when India allowed private companies to deliver mail, the amount of mail carried by the government's postal service dropped from 16 billion pieces in 1999 to less than 8 billion by 2005. India has also been among the many countries which have had government-owned telephone companies, but after this field was also opened up to private companies, these companies have driven the quality of service up and rates down on everything from local to long distance to cellular service to internet connections, according to the Wall Street Journal. Neither particular powers nor particular activities of government should be taken for granted as necessary to be performed by government simply because they have been in the past. Both need to be examined in terms of their incentives, constraints, and track records. Quite aside from the particular merits or demerits of particular government policies or programs, there are other considerations to take into account when expanding the role of government. These were expressed more than a century ago by John Stuart Mill. Every function superadded to those already exercised by the government causes its influence over hopes and fears to be more widely diffused and converts more and more the active and ambitious part of the public into hangers-on of the government, or of some party which aims at becoming the government. If the roads, the railways, the banks, the insurance offices, the great joint stock companies, the universities, and the public charities were all of them branches of government, if, in addition, the municipal corporations and local boards, with all that now devolves on them, became departments of the central administration, if the employees of all these different enterprises were appointed and paid by the government and looked to the government for every rise in life, not all the freedom of the press and popular constitution of the legislature would make this or any other country free otherwise than in name.